Last evening when we were at dinner, I discovered something. I'm not supposed to say this. It was supposed to be a secret. But unfortunately, I'm going to spill the beans. That in the afternoon sessions, people doze a lot. And especially those guys in the front rows. Without mentioning names. Yeah, they sleep. And after they wake up, they ask very long questions. Since I don't want to be asked long questions, I like to do something that hopefully will make people not to sleep. And I'm going to be very alert. So woe unto you if you are going to wing even a minute. I'll catch up with you. Once upon a time, in IWG Jam, we used to dance during sessions. And it is just a simple dance. It will only take you 2 minutes to learn. And you don't need to learn, you just follow instructions. And I'm going to be the lead author, so to speak. And it means that you can't dance when you are seated, so you need to give yourself some space. And it's going to be very simple. The song is simple, it's only one word. Can everybody say Ali? Baba. Alibaba. And you follow instructions. I know that most students are very poor in following instructions. Don't set your own exam. I'm the one setting the exam. The instructions are, you wait for me to do the first style. Then you do you dance exactly what I've danced. So when I go to the second one, when I'm doing the second one, you are doing the first one I did. So you have to be very attentive. When I do the third one, you're doing the second one. And we'll all be saying Alibaba, Alibaba. Can you try? Alibaba, Alibaba. Alibaba, Alibaba. Okay, stand up. Alibaba, Alibaba. 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 There's something that Nilfa said in her presentation. There are some feminists who are very allergic to macro modeling, but I do believe that as feminist economists, we should move along with the whichever field or whatever is happening in the sphere of macroeconomics. So that you also get along. And today, we have two sessions. We had a problem figuring out between me and my colleague, Kijon, how to go about it so that we don't really repeat ourselves. But we agreed that I'll do the general overview of macro models, and I'll give an illustration of how you can use how we have used a social accounting matrix for Kenya to analyze employment outcomes. And he'll do more of the mathematical derivations and a more detailed discussion of the social accounting CGE framework. So if questions come on social accounting models, they will be cross-cutting, and some of them will actually be taken upon by my colleague. When we talk about macro models, it's because you're also talking about from a macro point of view. most of the gender issues tend to be analyzed within the microsphere. But when you look at the the field of macroeconomics has really developed in the last few decades, and it's especially this particular network that has really gone ahead to try and bring in the macro perspectives, the gender issues into the macro perspectives. And as macroeconomists, I happen to be one, I think so, probably all of us. If you are an economist, I think you are a macroeconomist and micro, because in most universities we are taught both micro and macro. So you can wear different hats. So assume we are all macroeconomists. We are interested in how the whole economy works. And so we think in terms of models or the key relationships. We have all these households, we have these farms, but how do we aggregate them at that national level? How do their behavior at the micro level relate at the macro level when you are talking about all the economic agents? So this whole issue of macro models is basically a representation, some kind of mathematical, logical representation of economic relationships. You can look at it like a set of equations that explain how the economy works and how economic agents interact in the economy. So we are not only interested, for example, in manufacturing sector, we are not only interested in export sector, but we want to see how all these sectors interact at the national or at a macro level. Why do we need these macro models? Life can still go on without macro models. We don't need to complicate our life. We can just talk about issues. But the reality, we know that the world and reality, of course, is too complex. So what these macro models try to do is to try and simplify the reality and this complex society. In fact, there is no perfect model, strictly speaking. Because to start and imagine, to put in an equation, the behavior of an individual, or for example, an economic agent, is very difficult. So there are no perfect models, but that doesn't limit us, because it's really to give us some kind of a framework of logical thinking and a tool that provides some kind of coherent and consistent analysis of the economy. So that when you are talking about impact of policy, you look at it from a macro perspective, because you might be implementing policies in one sector, yet it has negative effects in another sector. And overall, the overall impact might actually turn out to be neutral if the negative effects are going to be felt. The positive effect in one sector will be neutralized with the negative effect in another sector. So that's why we need to have an understanding of that coherent and consistent framework. Models also, and I think Nilfa mentioned about this in the morning, they help us to clarify interactions in the economy, the magnitude of those interactions. They help us to test, illustrate, and some of those basic theoretical economic principles. Now, for example, when you talk about consumption in macroeconomics, we have various theories of consumption. I'm sure the PhD students can be very good, because I went to school many years ago. How many theories of consumption do we have? Any theories of consumption? One? Permanent income hypothesis. Relative income hypothesis. Life cycle hypothesis. What does permanent income hypothesis tell us?
Permanent consumption depends on permanent income.
Supposing I'm not an economist. talk about permanent income hypothesis, what are we trying to say about in terms of theories of consumption? Valeria. Or any that you know, we have life cycle hypothesis. We have any that anybody knows. Can the person explain? I have a reason why I'm asking this. I thought we have PhD students in economics. Am I right? Anyway, what I'm driving is that. If you look at these theories, for example, and you are trying to say this is the way economic behavior is modeled, that people are not likely to change their behavior in a certain time period, then you can actually model their behavior if people are not so erratic. For example, if you're not going to go mad because your income has doubled or tripled, and you go for... Of course, if men may go for holidays in Argentina, but there will be certain proportion of income that will be spent on their wives in Argentina, but it may not be something like maybe beyond what you would expect. In other words, over time there is a certain way economists, so to speak. Here we are not talking about gender; we are just talking about economics. The gender blend economics that we know. There is a certain way economic agents behave over time. And if you follow their behavior, you can actually model that behavior because they are unlikely to change their behavior. Such that, for example, in terms of consumption theories, you may say that people would consume a certain proportion of their income according to the Keynesian theory of consumption, or they actually borrow to smoothen their consumption, the life cycle hypothesis, for example. But the thing is, when you're talking about macro modeling, and I want to build a macro model for my country, will that hold? I know that people don't go to their bank to borrow to smoothen their consumption. So some of those theories are, in my context or in my country, they don't apply. So part of this is actually you can use macro models to test whether some of these theories really hold in different economic perspectives. And you may find that there are completely new other issues that explain consumption and not necessarily the permanent income hypothesis. Because first of all, the former financial market, as we were saying yesterday, they're underdeveloped, so you don't expect people to be living on their, borrowing to consume and that kind of thing. So you find that some of those theories may not hold. And it can also, so basically that's the point I was trying to illustrate, that these models can help to clarify interactions, illustrate some of the basic theoretical or economic principles that we learn and we know, and whether they hold in reality or not. And it can also help us illustrate relationships among a group of economic agents. Now, the other most important aspect why this field of macro modeling has really gained a lot of prominence is the use for policy simulation. Answering what if kind of questions. What will happen? For example, in the US, we know that the Obama package stimulus was about $800 billion US dollars. There are many options they would have used that $800 billion US dollars. I don't know. I'm not from US, but I don't know whether there's any analysis that was done to analyze what are the possible implications of various options of using that $800 billion US dollars. They might have decided to put all of it in infrastructure. They would have decided maybe they are going to to pamble of it in financial institutions. And so if you have like a macro model which maybe is robust enough, you can actually be able to analyze before a decision is undertaken, what are the likely outcomes of investing or expenditure of this kind of money? What are the outcomes if, for example, we invest in infrastructure? What are the number of jobs that are going to be created? If, for example, we decide to spend on goods and services to boost household income, what are the likely outcomes that are going to happen? And so you will maximize, you will actually go for the policy option that has the maximum, what you think, depending, of course, on your objectives. If your objectives is growth, you may want to take a go for a policy option that might maximize growth. If your objective is to create employment, you will go for an outcome that will maximize employment. So it all depends on what are your options. And so it really becomes easier than abstract thinking of, I don't know, maybe if we invest, this is the kind of number of jobs that we'll come up with. So it helps us to answer those kind of questions. What if scenarios, so that you can be able to evaluate policies. And the other, of course, the main reasons why we build macro models is basically for economic projections, which build foundations for decision making and planning. I do not know if in 2000, let's say in 2004, who knew that we are going to have a financial crisis? Maybe even as late as 2007. Was there any idea? I mean, could someone have figured out? In 2004. And that is very nice. So, that's very important. But who listened to those people? In fact, now the story, the other version of the story I was hearing is that actually part of the problem is that there was some misleading, people who are doing these, what is it called, financial projections, didn't figure out the risks. And so their models came up with very misleading results. But it all depends, because when the situation happens, everybody wants to take the safe side, of course. Nobody takes responsibility. But in terms of futuristic thinking, also, if you have this kind of models and you can see what is happening now, of course you are trying to come up with alternative scenarios in what happens in the medium term. And you can actually come up with various options that look, if this asset bubble, for example, someone had analyzed it as they are actually pointing out, and these outcomes were out there. If someone would have taken that option more seriously, maybe the impact of the financial crisis wouldn't have been so severe. So how do you go about this macro modeling business? Of course, we have to collect data, whether that time is overtime or over cross-section. And then I've already talked about having different theories explaining economic behavior of different economic agents. And so testing or using that data to see how it suits the theory, and to also put in, the most important thing when it comes to this is that you have to take into consideration the economic structure of the economy that you are trying to model. The economic structure of the US economy is completely different from the economic structure of my country. And so I cannot just take a US model here and then bring it there and put in the Kenyan data. It won't work. I've already said that these kind of models, they help us to explain different aspects of the economy. And the other reason why, of course, this whole issue of macro models becomes quite important is that, unfortunately or fortunately, but when it comes to gender, I think it is unfortunately, most economic analysis is heavily biased towards quantitative forms of analysis. And this one, you are not going to run away with it. I mean, it's a fact. Most of the time you want to be heard, you must be talking about some hardcore quantitative evidence or numbers. And so, although there is so much information in qualitative analysis, when it comes to what matters in economic analysis, it is more of, can you provide the evidence, the kind of discussion Nilfa was telling us in the morning. And if you don't have that evidence, it's very hard to like really convince your argue your case and say, yes, I have a case. So if you want to say women are suffering, what is the evidence that they are suffering? If men are the ones who are benefiting, can you produce the evidence? And this evidence has to be, unfortunately, quantitative in some kind of way. So it is becomes like, because of this heavy bias, economic analysis being heavily biased towards quantitative forms of analysis, macro models becomes quite popular because they are able to give us that those kind of quantitative analysis. You can be able to show that if you increase your expenditure maybe by 5%, GDP will go up by 2%. So you can quantify and you can be able to convince the policymaker, or if they are donors and you are desperate in need of money, you will get the money. But if you just say, oh, we need this money, am I wrong? You know, I have some representatives from donor community, and most of the time we really have to convince them that our poverty rates are either going down or so. It's a whole question of by how much. Yes, it's gone down by 50%, by 40%. Whether those numbers make sense or not, it doesn't matter. What we are interested in is seeing a number. So because of that, I'm saying, okay, macro models becomes quite important. And so the whole of this question of quantitative analysis, economic analysis, of course, I've already explained that underpins the assessment of economic policies, growth, whether you want access to aid, and whether you are trying to sell your policies to see, convincingly show that you have a case to argue for these policies to be implemented, you really must have. And so it becomes quite important, and that's why the question of gender issues then come in. And the question we always get challenged with is that, and this is a question that all of us can, I don't know. Are all gender issues easily amenable to quantifiability? We've talked about childcare, we've talked about household services. Because even now, as Indira mentioned, in the extended production SNA account, there was a lot of, you know, celebration about this extension of production account. But to me, I don't think much has changed. Because still, the services that I do in my house, nobody cares whether I slept at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. I mean, that's my own personal business. It's not being featured anywhere. And in fact, if we start talking about that extended production account, in the context of African countries, in terms of how you go out to capture them, is still a whole complex, it's not easy because the data is not there, the technical capacity and all that. So to what extent then the gender issues that become verifiable and amenable to this kind of verifiable empirical and quantitative analysis really becomes an issue. And as you go along, you'll find that basically that means that when it comes to macro modeling, most of these gender issues, then of course now the gender analysis kind of falls off because modeling is nothing but data and a combination of assumptions and theories. Because largely what you come up with or the type of model you build is basically guided by the type of data and the nature of data, and of course the theoretical underpinning and the assumptions that you make. So if already your data is not gendered, and if you don't have that, that's fine. Then you run into problems. So if the database is gender blind, so do the macro model. And if the macroeconomic underpinning is gender blind, the whole issue of this morning we had a very interesting session about how the macroeconomic schools of thought are gender blind. And if those are theories of consumption, theories of investment, theories of government expenditure, if those kind of theories are the ones that are actually best guiding the model and they're gender blind, then automatically your model will also be gender blind. Now, in terms of types of macro models, I wanted to tell Rania that we used my 5 minutes to ensure that the class does not sleep during the session. So we had some small dance. So would you kindly refund back my 5 minutes? And I can see the alert, so it has worked, at least so far. So far. But if I notice, I think I'll do another jig-jag. When you look at the development of macro models, it has basically followed the development in the field of macroeconomics over time, from, of course, the Keynesian economics to neoclassical and all that. Now, in terms of distinguishing features of macro models, we have what we call non-general equilibrium versus general equilibrium. We have macro models that are based on econometric estimations, where you do some parameters based on econometric gymnastics, or you calibrate your model based on some assumptions or key relationships. Time series, that is dynamic versus cross-section, or a one-point or static kind of analysis. Now I have to move very fast. So basically, at a more broader level, we could basically mention key examples of macro models as being the empirical macroeconometric models, the applied general equilibrium models. Now here we have had two key groups of models. They are now famous dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. I don't know how many of you have heard about this, but it's become very popular with central banks. And the computable general equilibrium models, you have the agent-based computational macro models. I'll not go into details about that because they are not quite common. And this is really at a complete macro level. But we also have simple frameworks or simple models like the RIMSIM of the World Bank and the financial programming model of IMF. Strictly speaking, these are actually not, it has been, strictly speaking, these are not macro models. They are kind of frameworks. But okay, we can still call them macro models. Of course, then there is a whole ado about this T21, and it's really sailing around. They are most of these guys are going to the African countries lobbying, and I'm sorry to say, UNDP, ECG, I don't know, this donor, whatever, they are pumping money to force our governments to take these models. And we don't know how they, I mean, it's like, it's supposed to work in every place. It can work in Ghana, Uganda, wherever. Regardless of the structure, I don't believe in this prototype kind of models, because I do believe that every country, every economy is unique in its own way. So, but there is still there's a lot of lobbying about this T21 thing, and especially when this millennium, it has been proved that it can help us analyze the millennium development goals and blah blah. Sorry to say the donors, they have been doing quite something about forcing our governments. Maybe forcing is too rude a word, but I've been. I remember in my country there was a session where we had a training on the T21, and then Minister of Planning also was under pressure from the UNDP to adopt another model, DSI model. There's another branch of fellas in Bangladesh. I don't know that you've heard about them. They're also selling their models, and it's around the whole thing of, you know, they can analyze everything that exists in the economy around this MDG. Okay. So what happened is that when the DSI guys, when the T21 guys discovered that Ministry of Planning was just about to strike a deal with the DSI guys, they got so annoyed. And I happen to have found the inside information that they actually protested to the UNDP that, look, how can you let these guys get the contract? And so at the last minute, that contract was cancelled from nowhere. And so these guys came on board. So it's also more of politics and commercialization of issues. I'll talk a bit about this macroeconometric forecasting models. I don't think I have much time. The history dates back, as I said, if you look at the development of macro models, it's basically followed the development of macroeconomics thinking theories. So you remember in the 1940s and 1950s, that's when we had the reign of the Keynesian economic thinking, and that's when we had the economists who set out to construct quantitative models to describe the dynamics observed in time series data. The first comprehensive quantitative macro model was developed by this Dutch guy called Tinbergen in Netherlands in 1936. But of course, after that, this became very popular in the US and in the UK. So basically, I'll have to go a bit fast. Most of these kind of models, they are developed along the aggregate demand, aggregate supply Keynesian framework. And they focus on empirical coherence. So you have some econometric or empirical estimations to obtain the parameters to show you the interactions between economic agents based on economic theory. They are based on time series data along the national system of accounts, the SNF framework. Hello, hello. But they'll penalize me for my time. So you see, I'm paying for it dearly.
I'll give you 5 minutes.
If I notice another person, you'll be sure you're going to dance that. You're going to lead. Actually, the person yes, I won't do it. I'll ask the person to come and lead, and I'll also follow. So, okay. So these macro frameworks, actually the macro models, they were heavily criticized in the 1970s. And of course, this was the famous Lucas critique. Those of you who have been in the field of economics, you know very well about this Lucas critique. And this guy, you know, said, you know, you cannot base policy on something, on parameters that has been estimated using the time series data, when actually you are developing a new policy, it will have no impact. And it was such a major blow to the development of macroeconomics, macroeconometric modeling, that in the 80s, and there was some kind of fizzling out. But what we know is that this particular branch of models has continued to thrive. And they are commonly used by governments, central banks, research policy institutions for forecasting and policy analysis. They are quite common in terms of formulation, and they are suitable for macroeconomic analysis and macro medium-term projections. They are largely, as I've already said, they are largely based on national accounts data, And I've already said that since this kind of system does not, the data itself, if there is any place where we have lagged behind in terms of gender is engendering the economic data. We've done well with, you know, the labor force, the what, but when it comes to economic data, I think we really not been able to do well. So they don't support, they are not amenable to gender-based analysis. Oh, so we can say they don't incorporate gender, so they are just gender blind. Now, because of that heavy criticism of the Keynesian-based macroeconomic models, we've had this other school of thought, the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, which is a branch of general equilibrium models. Fairly recent development, became popular in the 80s and 90s, partly a response to the Lucas critique, because one of the critique of the macroeconometric models developed with the Tinbergen and the team was that they were not founded on microeconomic foundations. And so what this other school of thought did is like to try and develop the macro models from the micro perspectives as opposed to macro. And so this kind of methodology attempts to explain aggregate economic phenomena, economic growth. They have been mainly used for analyzing business cycles. A lot of it actually, a number of papers based on the US economy and the blah, blah. And they're also becoming very popular in terms of analyzing the effects of monetary policy. So they're also very popular in most central banks. They place greater emphasis on theoretical coherence, begin by you have to specify a set of economic agents, and each is assumed to make optimal choice. Of course, based on the micro foundations of if they're households, they are maximizing utility. If they're farms, they are maximizing profits. So parameters reflect the preferences of maximization, subject to constraints faced by these economic agents. They abstract from sectoral details. So if you want sectoral details, you'll not find it here. I've already said that. They make strong assumptions. Let's go to CGE. CGE is a branch of general equilibrium macro models. And like the DSGE, they are often micro-founded on assumptions about preferences, technology, and budget constraints. They focus on, basically been mainly used to analyze tax and trade policies and poverty and income distribution. They sort of embrace multiple interacting economic agents, highly structural, behavior derived from optimization. The problem and major criticism of CGE is that they're static, but now there is a lot of work going on in terms of building dynamic CGE models. I've already said they've already been used to that. They've been more influential in research and academic arena. PhDs, so many of them. If you look at the maybe journal articles, so many of them. But they've not really been penetrated the policymaking arena in terms of government and maybe perhaps of the complexity and the level of detail. However, if you compare with the other macroeconometric models, they have supported gender analysis. But again, this has to be a deliberate effort. It's not just automatic. So you can have CGE models which are completely gender blind if it is not deliberate. So they are based on a detailed input-output social accounting matrix. I'll not go into that. Now, in the case of Kenya, we have a social accounting matrix, which was built in 2003 jointly between IFPRI. IFPRI has been has played a very central role in terms of this CGE kind of modeling and my institute where I was working. And we also have a macroeconometric focusing model that we developed in 2000. I have some publications. I actually worked for all the 8 years I was working in my institution. I was involved in the development of the macro model, and it's been quite actively used by the government and the treasury in macroeconomic framework and national budgetary process. And I think in my view, it was a major, not really from a gender perspective, but I think in terms of building capacity or having some objective way of doing things in government, it was maybe not success, but something that was appreciated. Because what used to happen is that we used to have the IMF set the targets for inflation, growth rates, everything, because of lack of capacity on the side of the government. And when they do the evaluation, they say, you failed the target, so we are not going to give you the aid of all the loans. But when you actually try to analyze who set the targets to begin with, it wasn't us. You told us inflation will be 2%. You said the GDP will grow by 5%. We didn't say that. I'm fine. Please don't harass me more than that. So although I would say that the model has not played a significant role in terms of gender, at least it has played a role in terms of building capacity in government. I mean, like helping the government in terms of engaging even with the financial institutions like IMF. It is, of course, I won't go to that because of time. The model is demand-driven in the short run. It contains 12 behavioral variables and several semi-behavioral and secondary variables. Designed, of course, I've already said most of these models are based on SNF framework. And I think one of the issues that sort of made the model to really sell was the fact that it was built in an Excel platform, which is fairly simple to operate. One of the problem, and I think why the CG models have also not really been quite used so much in the government, is because, again, the kind of platform or software is uses, most people find it complex. You have to learn GAMS. But when it comes to something like Excel, it's something that, of course, everybody can operate an Excel worksheet. So it was kind of user-friendly, and that made an impact. The model is being revised. Of course, I've left the institute, so the other guy is in charge. I already said there's nothing gender about it. Now, in terms of SAM that was developed, this social accounting matrix, strictly speaking, was not really built with the aim of doing gender analysis. It was a project between IFPRI and the institute, and they were not interested in the gender. So to some extent, the Kenyan social matrix was not so gendered. Now here, there is a colleague of mine who is going to take the second presentation, who will talk more about social accounting matrix. But we said that it's hard for me to say how we used it without telling you, just in a snapshot, what is a social accounting matrix. For your information, there are people here who are gurus in social accounting matrix, like Indira, etc. So I'll not pretend to be the expert here. It's a matrix of interaction between production, income, consumption, and capital accumulation. It gives a snapshot of the economic structure consistent and also for analyzing income and expenditure flows. And the beauty of having a social accounting matrix is that you can see the consistency along the multisectoral, from the multisectoral sectors all together in at once and in the interactions within the economy. And these interactions within Assam, they actually help us. We were able to, before you start even worrying about how you are going to build CGE, because most people find CGE to be too complex. But the beauty is there is a lot of analysis that you can just do with this kind of social accounting matrix through what we call, for example, the multiplier analysis. So you, even if you are not able to build a CGE, you can do a lot of analysis using the social accounting matrix. And already there is a lot of interest and work, and I'm sure Rania and the team has actually a whole project on this, which part of which Kijon is going to be presenting. There's a lot of interest now in social accounting matrix. Now, for example, in our case, we didn't go to the CGE, but we sort of there has been saying they'll say okay, there's plans to do a CGE, but those plans have been plans for so long, so I don't know when they are going to do it. It impresses the double entry, where we have expenditures in columns and incomes in rows. Now, it's a bit hard to explain this in abstract, but one of the presentations that Kijon will be doing will be able to show you some spreadsheets, which I don't want to go into. For each sector, total income must equal total expenditure. So that's why it is basically a matrix. And it embodies the national accounts at macro level. And the beauty of the social accounting matrix is that you are able to see the interactions between the macro and the micro, or what you call the meso levels. So you can do the disaggregation, of course, depending on the availability of data, based on the input-output table, which is basically a subset of the social accounting matrix. Now, in terms of what we have this input-output table, you need to go beyond the input-output table if you want to see the indirect and the direct linkages. Because what the input-output table will do for you is that it will basically stop at the production accounts, and it will not go into the linkages, like what happens to the factors of production, what happens to the households, and the impact of how that income is distributed. And I've already said that even without worrying about CGE, you can use some as some basis of some simple modeling using the multiplier analysis. So we have output, input, output multipliers, which basically these are, they only capture direct and indirect effects of a change in exogenous demand. However, they don't capture induced effects on factors of production and household incomes. And this, so when you want to do the linkages, is then you better use the social accounting matrix multiplier analysis, since these ones show the linkages among different sectors, both indirect and indirect. Now, there are various assumptions, and of course, these are also part of like limitations. We have standard accounts, we have the production account, we have factors of production, we have institutions, government, capital account, rest of the world. So when you start from the production account, there's some production taking place, there is value addition, that value addition it's distributed to income, in terms of income institutions, which then goes to the households. So for example, if you take the first column, no, the second column, we have production and product markets. Now, for them to produce, of course, the income is distributed through the value addition. For example, you pay your labor, and that is the value addition. I will not go too into this because of details. Now, in terms of the Kenyan sum, we had, of course, the standard accounts. In terms of disaggregation, we had 20 production account was disaggregated into 27 sectors. And we had factors which we decided to disaggregate by employment categories. And since we were interested in gender, we did it, of course, also region, urban, rural, sector, formal, informal, because informal sector is a very big chunk of the economy in Kenya. Skilled versus unskilled. Now, to analyze the employment outcomes, we had to construct an employment satellite account, which was outside the, of course, the standard social accounting matrix. And we, of course, it was not so easy because of data problems. But we used the national employment data, and then we used the various labor force surveys to disaggregate that data. I'll just go to, because of time, I'll just go to some of the outcomes, the simulation results. We found that we had three priority sectors: agriculture, services, and manufacturing. And these sectors were selected based on the highest, in terms of which sectors had the highest linkages, backward and forward linkages. And in our country, these are the sectors with the highest backward and forward linkages. So we chose these three sectors. And we found that the selected sectors, we did some simulations based on five options. Why you say, okay, what if you invest only in agriculture, manufacturing, private, or if you invest in both agriculture and manufacturing, or all the three, what are the outcomes? Now, in terms of incomes, investing in agriculture yielded the highest increase in incomes. And of course, this is intuitive because agriculture is labor, I mean, it is labor intensive. But the highest increase was registered in the informal sector. Now, in terms of gender, overall, male accounted for 80% of the increase in the income, which means that the proportion of female, this is because the proportion of female in the informal sector is very high. So if there are any incomes that are generated because of extra investment, it's mainly men who are going to benefit. And in terms of skilled labor benefited most, 70% compared to less skilled. And again, when you come to who are the people who are skilled, you find that most of them are men. So again, men were the main beneficiary in terms of who benefits in terms of the skill. Agriculture yielded the highest increase in incomes. But again, this increase benefits rural households because in most African contexts, agriculture is a rural phenomenon. So if you want to boost incomes in the rural areas, then you really have to think about agriculture because that is like the main economic activity in most of our economies. Investing in services and manufacturing just benefits the urban folks. So analysis by gender wasn't possible. Okay. Now in terms of employment, that was in terms of income. In terms of employment, we found that when you invest in the manufacturing sector, you create more jobs, especially also for women, which more of these jobs will benefit women. And I think this can be explained because what is happening with this export orientation, we've had these export processing zones, and most of them actually employ women because they are cheap and they work in most of these textile industries. So you will say that, okay, the manufacturing sector has high potential for employment, but what type of jobs? If you look at the type of jobs, these are actually casual laborers and these export processing zones, some of which has really been highly contested, working conditions have been raised and that kind of thing. The formal sector is male-dominated. So I'll just go to some of the conclusions. Okay, So these were conclusions after all. Investing in priority sectors is bound to benefit men disproportionately than women, both in terms of earnings and employment opportunities. And of course, this sort of can be explained in terms of the socioeconomic structure. Women are crowded in the informal sector. Men are, mainly dominated in the formal sector. So those results actually kind of can be explained along the socioeconomic structure. There is need to improve skills for females, because those ones with lower education were actually the ones that were missing out on income. And as I've already said, if you ever think about boosting rural incomes, at least in the context of most African countries, you have to do something about agriculture. Now, our paper is actually coming out anytime in the special issue on gender and inequality in the feminist economics. I think it's already online. So just by any chance, if anybody's interested, you can have a look. Thank you very much for not dozing also.